You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life. Hey, welcome back, everyone. Today, we want to cover something that seems quite simple until you have to do it in practice, and that's buying and managing your share portfolio. So in many cases, there's actually a little more to it than meets the eye. Once you've been doing it for a while, you can get into the trap of thinking that it's really straightforward and really simple and really obvious. However, when new investors or new people to the FIRE community get into this, it can be pretty daunting and pretty intimidating. So we will discuss the ins and outs, when to buy, how often, balancing your portfolio, all those typical questions you get from a new investor or a new person to the FIRE community.
Yeah, we've had a few of these type of questions hitting our inbox. And I remember, like you said, Pat, it's hard to remember back to when you first started, but sometimes it can be a little bit overwhelming at first because there's all these things to figure out how to do for the first time when you are getting into buying shares. And we'll also talk about selling when you need the money, like whether you're retired or not, how do you go about doing that? And this also gets a little bit into the topic of asset allocation, like in terms of how do you spread the money between different holdings. So we'll get into that a bit. And of course, we'll share what we do ourselves in terms of how we manage our portfolios.
Yeah, and that's the really interesting part because Dave and I sometimes do these things a bit different. So
there's often no perfect answer for everyone because everyone has their own kind of unique situations. You often find people doing things differently to one another, even though they might be generally investing the same way. It doesn't mean they follow exactly the same kind of plan or process every single time.
Yeah. But before we get into this, just to cover a comment on our audio for our last episode, the post-production left a little bit to be desired. I take full responsibility for that because I'm in charge of post-production over here at Fire and Chill. We've got no excuses. We use some automated programming. I didn't check it properly. We sent it out into the wild and we snipped quite a few words off our sentences. Just letting you know that we know it's a problem. We'll hopefully make sure it doesn't happen again. Sweet. Okay, let's get into it. Do you want to kick us off, Dave?
All right, let's get started. So first, when we are getting into building a portfolio, we first need to buy those shares. And to do that, we need to choose a broker. And we need to decide whose name we will be investing in the first place. If you're a customer at a big bank, you'll find that they will have their own type of brokerage accounts, and maybe you've even got one that you opened in the past. Pat, you use your bank brokerage, don't you?
Yes, I do. I am with CommBank and I use CommSec as my brokerage account.
Okay, and this is just another example of Pat being a nice big fat cat over there spending the big bucks to use the convenience of CBA.
You're 100% correct. I like only opening one app on my phone and seeing my investments and my bank accounts all in that same place and being able to manage them all in the same place. And if that means I need to pay an extra $100 a year in brokerage, that's just the cost of doing business as far as I'm concerned.
So, mate, you should have got your home loan with CBA as well then.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that wouldn't only be $100 a year. That would have costed me far, far more than $100 a year. And that was not worth it.
Yeah.
So I'm not willing to pay thousands and thousands of dollars for that convenience. But $100 a year, I I think that's worth it.
Yeah, good point. So if you are with a big bank, it can be the easiest option to just open a brokerage account that they have to offer. And you might be paying, say, $15 or $20 a month versus maybe $9 with a lower cost brokerage firm. That sounds about right to you, Pat?
Yeah, and just to clarify, we're not actually paying a dollar amount per month. You're paying a dollar amount per trade.
Yeah, sorry.
But Dave and I are just assuming we're making about one trade a month. And so that's why we've said per month, but it's actually per trade.
Yeah, good point. My bad.
But first, how would you describe what a broker is to someone who's never invested anything before, Dave?
I would call it a online platform where you can buy and sell shares. What would you call it?
Well, I actually think the easiest way to conceptualize this, and I know this is fundamentally inaccurate, so don't come and tell me I'm an idiot, but for a newbie conceptualizing this, a broker kind of acts in the same way as your conveyancer when you're buying a house. They facilitate the transfer of ownership to you when you make a purchase. So you go to your broker, you tell them what you want to buy. This is all through the online platform. And then they facilitate the transfer of the ownership of that to you. But they're not involved. They don't own the managed fund. They don't own the shares. Once they've transferred the ownership to you, you still have your online platform, but otherwise they're not actually involved in the investment at all.
Yeah, they're just the third party that helps those buyers and sellers come together and make the transaction happen.
Yeah, correct. And they're a necessary part of the equation. So it's not something that you can go and transfer yourself, or it would be impractical to go out and try and transfer shares between you and other people.
And if you are looking to open an account and you don't have one and you would like to choose one that's maybe a lower cost option rather than a big bank option, two of the more popular ones and the cheaper ones are Self Wealth and Perla, which you might have seen around the place. All right, so how do we decide whose name to invest in, Pat? Because when we open this brokerage account, we need to decide, okay, whose name is this account going to be in? Because that's the person who's going to be owning those shares that are bought.
Yeah, so generally, if you're part of a couple, you may decide to invest or open the brokerage account in the lower income earner's name. Dave and I got into this a bit last week. It's not always that straightforward to try and do the whole investing in one person's name over the other perfectly over the course of someone's lifespan. But like we said last week, in general, if you can manage it, invest in the lower person's name to begin with. And then as you approach what you deem to be your retirement age, try and even out the amount of money you've invested in each person's name.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. The simplest option, of course, is just to invest in a joint account and not worry too much about it. Of course.
Yeah. And for reference, that's exactly what I do. I am in a higher tax bracket than my partner, Steph, but we own shares through a joint account because that's the easiest and simplest way for us to do it. And once we stop earning so much money, or once I come down in tax bracket,
It'll even out
a lot, and we'll end up paying the same amount of tax anyway. So the joint account makes that really easy to manage in our circumstance.
And I think you pointed this out in a previous episode that you like to have the joint account because it lets you both see what you're contributing to all in the one spot, rather than having a big portfolio over here and maybe a little one over here that you haven't quite built yet. When you have this goal together, it's kind of more powerful if you see it together all in the one thing that you're putting money towards.
Yeah, exactly. It's as anyone who's in a couple knows, it's all about working together, joint goals, joint aspirations, and having it all go into the same place is just more motivating from that point of view. Mm. And given what I just said about trying to even out by the time you get to the end anyway, if we were investing in individual accounts, we'd already be in that position where we're trying to even out our investments. So it's not that big a drag, a bit of extra tax we're going to pay over the next few years compared to the next 40 or 50 where we're going to be in this joint account paying the same amount of tax each.
There's basically no way to figure out who's going to be at a higher tax bracket over the next 30 years or 40 years.
No, there isn't.
So if you haven't quite started investing in shares yet and it feels a little bit scary or a little bit confusing to open that account and knowing what to do, I did write an article about the different steps that you need to take, and I broke it down in very simple terms that should be easy for you to understand. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes if you feel like you want or need some help with that kind of process and signing up and doing it for the first time.
Yeah, good stuff.
All right, Pat. So the big question, mate, when should you buy shares?
I think the way you wanted to word that, Dave, was when is the best time to buy shares?
Yeah, that's true. That's really what I meant.
So when the shares have a PE ratio of less than 15, the economy is going well and it's strong, and experts are forecasting a strong year of growth for the markets.
That makes sense to me. That sounds pretty sensible, doesn't it?
Just kidding, guys. We don't get involved in market timing or looking at PE ratios. We leave those for the experts that don't perform as well as the market anyway. They need to get paid to do something.
Oh, you had to stick that sucker punch in, didn't you, mate?
It was a bit of a kidney punch.
No, so as you probably heard us say before, we would recommend that you invest when you have the money to invest and when you can leave it there for a long time. Does sound better to wait and then buy when prices come down and when prices fall, but we don't really know when that's going to be. You know, it's going to happen at some point, but nobody knows when that's going to be. And waiting usually leaves you worse off, sometimes much worse off than if you had just invested regularly over time, and much less. It creates some psychological kind of trauma and games that you start playing and tricking yourself. And we've covered that in a previous episode, so we won't get into that too much, but we would just say to invest when you have the money.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone's situation's a bit different, of course, and Dave and I are always going to put in the disclaimer that we're not professionals and this isn't meant to be professional advice and all that sort of business. But go out there and find the research yourself. It's all out there. Timing the market is a fool's errand. So that's, Dave and I generally agree with that. So we don't look at PE ratios. We don't wait until there's a dip. We don't know if a dip is coming. None of that business. It's just you buy shares when you have the money available to you to buy shares.
Mm. And so if we had to put a dollar amount on that, Pat, in terms of what is a suitable, like when you reach what kind of level of cash would you put that into the market? I think something like $1,000 is a good little benchmark to kind of work off. That would be a good time to invest. Any less than that, and I feel like brokerage would start to become too much, like a too big a percentage of your purchase. What do you think?
I've always said more around the $3,000 range,
okay,
to be honest. And something like $3,000 to $5,000 is more where I'd peg it.
Okay. But
it really does depend on how much you earn, how much you can save, how often you can invest. So if you're saving a very small amount of money, such that getting to $4,000 would just take a very, very long time, then it may be better to invest more frequently at smaller amounts. However, if you're saving very rapidly because you have a very high income and you don't eat it all up, then getting to those higher amounts may be more beneficial. But this is exactly where Dave and I are going to get to next for our next topic.
Great segue, mate.
So how often should we buy? Quarterly, monthly, weekly? It's a pretty typical question we get. I think monthly is pretty good. Dave, do you think monthly is pretty good?
Yeah, I do, man. Monthly is actually, I think monthly is perfect because it usually gives you enough time to save up like $1,000 or more. For most people should be able to manage that. And then also monthly gives you something to look forward to each month. So it keeps you engaged and motivated rather than if you wait for like 3 months, it just feels too long. Like if you're doing it monthly, you feel like you're way more, I don't know, it just feels like more proactive and more.
You're making progress.
Yeah, there's more progress happening more frequently and it just feels more interesting and engaging and whatever. It just keeps you focused on it, I think, that monthly amount.
Yeah. So some people do wait for 3 months to have a big amount. So that way their brokerage doesn't make up a huge amount of their purchase or a huge percentage of their purchase, I should say. Mm. I don't know if there's a right and wrong way to do this, to be honest. But there are, again, general rules or general takeaways. Because obviously you could go to one extreme and do it like once a year, or you could go to the other extreme and do it like twice a week or every day. Yeah. And that would be obviously very stupid because you'd just kill yourself with brokerage.
And I suppose you have to balance. So imagine if you waited the whole year, that also means you've invested no money for 12 months. So you're also missing out on some returns over that time. So you kind of have to balance that with it as well, the kind of returns you expect to earn over time.
Exactly. There's no use keeping $5,000 out of the market for 6 months because you're going to save $20 brokerage to buy $10,000 after 1 year. So there is actually a sort of simple mathematical calculation to get the theoretical optimum investing frequency. And I have to say theoretical because it makes assumptions about the growth in the market over time, whereas that can't be known ahead of time. We just use the average 8% growth.
Just some or whatever basic kind of expectations that the calculator has to work with.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a calculator that someone has made, so you don't need to come up with the calculations yourself. And Dave and I will link to that calculator in the show notes. But just beyond that, Dave and I have had a play around with this calculator. And it'll give you some investing frequencies like, oh, your most optimum investing frequency is every 5 weeks or every 6 weeks. The difference after 20 years or something is like $1,000 on a $2 million portfolio.
Yeah.
I think all I'm trying to say here is if you want to invest monthly because it's easier to keep that cadence for yourself and you get paid monthly, whereas the calculator gives you an optimal investing frequency of every 6 weeks, maybe monthly is just easier for you because that's how you get paid.
And yeah, of course.
Over 20 years, losing $1,000, that might be on a $2 million finishing portfolio size, that might be worth it. Just for the simplicity and the cadence and the pattern and the rhythm of you and your work and your life.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the case. It's another example where I don't think you want to get too lost in the calculations or in this kind of spreadsheet land and follow kind of what's the most practical and easiest and even the most enjoyable solution for you. So if you find investing every 4 weeks more enjoyable, like once a month more enjoyable than every 6 weeks, then do it. If you're going to pay a tiny bit extra over time in brokerage costs, then I don't think that's such a big deal.
Yeah. And the good thing about this calculator we link to is that it will give you a couple of different scenarios. So it'll tell you how much money you'll end up having theoretically if you invested once every 4 weeks or once every 6 weeks, and you'll see just how little a difference it often makes.
I was actually surprised, Pat, at how small the difference was. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I was surprised at how small a difference it was. Mm. And it just goes to show sometimes we can definitely get our heads in the weeds and worry about cents when you should be more worried about your life.
Yeah, 100%. All right, so moving on to the next topic here. So what about if you have multiple holdings or multiple things that you want to buy for your portfolio? How do you balance buying all of them? This is a common question that new investors often have. So let's say somebody has, they've chosen this kind of portfolio they want to build, and there's three or four different funds that they want to put in this portfolio. How do they actually go about building that portfolio? Do they buy each one of them every month, or what do they do, Pat? Because that'd be pretty expensive, wouldn't it?
That would be very expensive. You're basically quadrupling your brokerage cost. The answer is no, you shouldn't do that. You should take it in turns. So if you've got four funds in your portfolio, each month you would just choose whichever fund is furthest under target and buy that one.
And so they all start at zero. So essentially you're just going to have to buy one at a time for 4 months and then add from there.
Yeah, exactly. Something else to mention here, when you are starting out, you're typically starting out with a pretty small dollar amount in any case. Don't overthink it. When you're investing your first $5,000, whether you have 50% in VGS and 50% in VES, or if you've just got the whole lot in VGS, it's not going to make a difference.
Nah.
Like, I know it's a lot of money to begin with, $5,000, but over the course of your life, it's going to be an insignificantly small amount of money. throw it all into one fund, in the next month buy the other one, and then slowly work your way to your target allocations.
Yeah. So the more money you have in your portfolio, the more that diversification and where you have that money really matters. But when there's only a small amount in the portfolio, it doesn't really matter yet.
Exactly. People will often come up with their target portfolios right when they begin, which is a really great move. Don't get me wrong, I'm not dissing that at all. But it will often be something like 40% in VGS, I want 30% in VAS, I want 20% in VGAD, 10% in VGE. This is great, but just remember as well, 10% of $5,000 is $500. Don't be buying no VGE at $500. Like, it's a waste of time. It's not going to make a huge difference. I almost say until you get to about $100,000, it's often pointless having any more than a couple of funds in your portfolio.
So once your portfolio hits that amount, you're saying that then it becomes more practical and more reasonable to have those extra slices in your portfolio that aren't a big dollar amount or aren't a big percentage.
Yeah, correct. So if you're doing the roll your own style where you're having VAS, VGS, VGE, for example, VGE is going to make a tiny proportion because it's the emerging markets portion. You don't need to buy that until you've got some significant wealth, say 50 to 100,000, I say.
That's a good thing to point out.
Yeah, before then, it's just silly. It's not going to make a big enough difference to worry with the extra hassle.
Yeah, good point. Extra administration too.
Yeah, exactly. You're administering like this $3,000 holding or something. It's like, what's the point?
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think of that. So as your portfolio gets bigger, you'll essentially just want to top up whichever of those holdings is under your target. So say something is like 20% of your portfolio, but you want it to be 25%, then you would probably top up that one as an example. All right, so the next thing we want to talk about is how do we balance our portfolio all the time? And so when you're building a portfolio, you're going to decide what you want to put, like how much you want to put in each holding, like we just talked about. And that's part of this discussion around asset allocation, which we did talk about, and that was episode number 16. And I caught myself at this point, Pat, where I'm noticing that in the episodes, we're able to like reference back to a bunch of other stuff that we've already done. How weird does that feel?
It's great because at least we've covered it before and people have heard it before. And so we don't feel like we have to cover every tiny little topic in every episode as though it's a standalone thing. Mm. We can assume that people have listened to our previous episodes.
They better.
Which makes these flow a little better. Or at least have read up elsewhere on these topics in the past, maybe.
Yeah. But I was just thinking how when you can refer back to other episodes, it makes you feel like you've been doing it for a long time, or we've covered a fair bit in our first like 15 months or whatever it is that we've been going for.
Yeah. Man, 15 months, that's a long time. So as your portfolio gets larger, it'll move around quite a lot just with market movements. Maybe you wanted a holding to be 20% of your portfolio, but it keeps growing faster than your other investments. If you've got a target allocation, you probably want to bring that back into line with your target allocation instead of letting it grow all of its own will and get to a disproportionate amount of what you want it to be in your portfolio.
Well, I think it depends, doesn't it? How much you're willing to, like how much it's growing faster than the others. Because that's the thing, you'll have different investments growing at different, like they'll have different performances over time. So you might have some investments are struggling, so they're actually, their price might be down while others might be up. So you probably add to the ones that are down, for example. And the one that keeps growing is, it might be getting a bigger percentage. And if it gets way above 20%, if 20% was what you had in mind that you wanted for that fund, then if it gets to like maybe an uncomfortable level, like 30 or 35, then maybe sell some if that was your plan. But then you're obviously going to be paying some taxes. So there's a few things to consider when that situation is occurring, because you could just still focus on topping up the other ones so that proportion of that one comes down a bit over time rather than selling to pay the tax. So there's a few things to consider.
Yeah, and I was going to say that is probably the best way to do it if still possible. just direct your cash inflows into the funds that haven't been performing as well, and that will naturally balance your portfolio over time. And this is really easy to do. Like we said before, you just check what fund is below its target allocation or the furthest below its target allocation, and you just buy into that. But there may come a time where some funds really get disproportionately out of whack, where your inflows can't bring them into line quickly enough that you're comfortable with it. And this will particularly begin to happen as your portfolio gets very, very large. Once it gets very large, the market movements have more of an effect on the portfolio value than your cash contributions do. Whereas when you're just starting out, it's the opposite way around. Your cash contributions make up most of the growing size of the portfolio, and the market movements have little to no impact almost.
In terms of the proportion
that it's progressing and growing.
Yeah.
So you could be strict and keep everything at a set percentage, or you could have a range and let things run out a bit and have a bit more of relaxed targets to work towards. There's no perfect answer here, unfortunately, I think.
I think it's tricky because it depends how much you're able to add to your investments, and then also how out of line that kind of that holding that's growing quickly is becoming, and whether you're comfortable with that or not, and how comfortable you are with selling it to pay some taxes to rebalance and stuff like that. So there's not really a right answer there.
So it also depends on your tax bracket as well then, because some people can rebalance relatively cheaply, whereas others, such as myself, like rebalancing can cost much more because I'm in a very high tax bracket.
Yeah, good point.
So Dave, what about having some personal picks in your portfolio? What do you think? Just little gambles, little things you're passionate about and you think are going to grow and you've got the magic touch.
So we've already discussed that, the idea of that in like the asset allocation podcast. So we're not judging that topic now. It's more about how should people approach it when they do have other stuff in their portfolio like this. So how do they kind of balance that, balancing the rest of their portfolio? And so maybe it might be like 5% or 10% of their portfolio. They've got some random investments that are in there next to their kind of their index funds or whatever else they have that's like their boring long-term stuff, their diversified investments. I think this is actually quite common. So if those investments, like those hand-picked investments, we'll call them, if they've done pretty poorly, they didn't work out for whatever reason, there's actually not really a lot you need to do. Because it's not turning out the way you expected. So you can kind of just use those as like tax write-offs when you want to maybe offset some capital gains at some point. They'll just be sitting in your portfolio until you want to get rid of them. The only kind of problem, and I guess it's a good problem to have, is when those investments, those hand-picked investments do really well, then they will become maybe a disproportionate size, much bigger than maybe you wanted them to be. So maybe it's a stock that you bought that was like 1 or 2% of your portfolio, but that stock explodes and now it's 10 or 15% of your portfolio. That can be tricky, right? Because you don't really want to have that stock be such a big part of your portfolio, but then to sell it, you'll have to pay some taxes, but you're reducing the risk of your kind of portfolio. So it can definitely make sense to pay the tax in that case and kind of spread that money back into your more diversified investments.
And the thing is, psychologically, that must be so tough, especially if it's like a hand-picked thing and it's done really, really well. Psychologically, to sell something that has been a really huge winner for you and trim it back. I think a lot of people would have this problem. And this might be the case where someone may have put a bit of Bitcoin in their portfolio, their gamble, and now it's like exploded and it's made a huge part of their portfolio. You can definitely see that their views may be affected by the fact that it's been such a big winner. And now they may have even more belief that it's going to continue to be a big winner into the future.
Yeah, it becomes a psychological game, doesn't it?
It does.
It's tricky, man. I think you probably want to take some money off the table with some of those big winners, as hard as it would be, because you're just going to reduce the risk of your portfolio and just make it back to, or put it back to that kind of comfortable level that you had in mind. And yeah, I just think the tax is not such a bad, it's a cost of reducing your risk, I suppose. And it's a good problem to have in the first place. So it's not something to fret over too much.
Well, I've never believed in having 5 to 10% of your portfolio for gambles anyway, so...
Mate, like I said, we're not judging in this one. We're just saying, if this is the case, how do you manage it?
Yeah, but my context will paint my view.
That's always the case, though.
Yeah, it's true. Just letting everyone know where I'm coming from when I tell them to just sell it.
So sell all of it and don't do it.
You've had a win. You went to the casino and you've won. Now you take your winnings. You get out of the casino. If you stay in the casino will eventually get your money.
Mate, the whole market's a casino. Haven't you heard?
Oh, fuck. Some people say that. Some people really, really believe that.
Yeah, I know. Hence my comment.
Yeah.
All right, so a little bit more on taxes. How do we deal with the taxes in our back to our normal portfolio, we'll call it? How do we deal with that on a yearly basis? So with any sort of normal portfolio, if your shares are paying dividends, which they very likely are, or you sell any of your shares during the year, you have to declare the income from the shares and also the capital gains if you've sold some, or capital losses if you made a loss on that sale. You'll have to declare that at tax time to the ATO, and you will get statements for each, usually electronic statements for each dividend that you get. That'll usually come by your email. So it can be easy to record it like that. But if you do wait until August, maybe September, usually that stuff is pre-filled for you now in your tax return, which is pretty cool. It seems to be getting a little bit easier every year in terms of how much is auto-filled. Have you noticed that, Pat?
Yeah, definitely. I still remember back in the day when we were doing paper tax returns.
Oh, mate, you sound like 100 years old.
I know. Crazy. And then we had that whole period where it was e-tax, where it was like a Windows program that you downloaded. And now we've moved on to the MyGov, MyTax, is it?
It's pretty cool, man, I think. I like it.
Oh, yeah, it's great. Love it.
Good way to spend a Saturday night, hey, mate.
Great way to spend a Saturday night. And if you're in a position like mine, you wait until the end of October before you put that tax return in anyway. So,
because you get that bill, don't you? That big bill.
I get a bill. Yeah, I get a bill every year.
I get a refund, mate, because I'm on the old retiree tax bracket, the zero tax bracket. So I get those nice juicy franking credit refunds.
Oh, mate, the low income tax offset.
Beautiful. So anyway. Like I was saying, if you wait until this kind of time of year, usually that stuff, a lot of it is pre-filled for you, but sometimes it's not. So you do still have to check it anyway. And in terms of like the capital gains and capital losses, I have pretty much always used ShareSite ever since the beginning of investing in shares. I don't know about you, Pat. Have you used it the whole time?
No.
No?
Well, I started investing 2012, I think, or 2013.
Was it around then?
I don't know if ShareSite was around then. In any case, I hadn't heard of it at the very least. So I kept my paper records and done all the calculations myself for capital gains and capital losses.
Yeah.
But ShareSite makes this a lot easier. And this is a segue impromptu plug for ShareSite.
So you will notice that. For capital gains, it makes it, if you would have noticed it, Pat, hey, doing your tax return, you could click the button, get your tax report, and it spits out the capital gains and capital losses and whatever, man.
Yeah, 100%. It makes it super easy, and it helps you do the selection of particular units that you want to buy and sell as well, depending on what you want to achieve that financial year. So if you're in Dave's position where he's, I think, in the 0% tax bracket. I'm not sure.
Pretty much.
In that case, you may want to maximize capital gains tax through ShareSite so you can raise your cost base as far as possible, his average cost base.
Yeah, so basically just sell the ones with the biggest. If I'm selling, I choose the units to sell that have the biggest gains embedded in them, and that means the ones with the smallest gains get left for later when I'm probably in a bigger tax bracket so that there'll be less tax owing when I'm in a bigger tax bracket.
Yeah, precisely. Whereas someone in my position where I'm on a huge tax bracket right now, I would do the opposite. I would select the shares to sell with the lowest embedded capital gains, so I pay the least amount of tax now.
Mate, it sounds like we play a little bit more tax games than we let on then.
Oh, geez, don't say that. We're gonna lose our street cred.
Our stoic status as the people who don't care about tax.
So the reason we're just mentioning ShareSite here is because we actually both use it and genuinely like it. You won't hear us promoting crap we don't use, so anything to do with the Cayman Islands tax specialist, dodgers or payday lenders or incomprehensible tax structures which apparently save you tax but may not actually save you any tax whatsoever once you look into it is stuff that we won't be mentioning here.
All right, so let's get into a little bit of how each of us manages our portfolios on a regular basis. So what do you do, Pat, mate? I mean, how do you balance your portfolio? When do you buy your shares and all the rest of it? Walk us through that a little bit.
As mentioned earlier in the episode, I just use my bank's broker, CommSec.
Pay that lazy tax.
I pay that lazy tax in inverted commas. I don't like to call it lazy tax. I call it a convenience tax.
Aha. Uh-huh. How convenient a way to frame it.
Very convenient way to frame it. I have a four-fund portfolio made up of VGS, VGAD, VAS, and VGE with certain percentages allocated to each of them. I buy monthly with my partner, Steph, in a joint bank account, and I just buy the single fund which is furthest below its asset allocation. So, for example, I have VAS. I want it to be 20% of my portfolio. If VAS is less than 20% and the rest of my holdings are more than their allocations, I will buy VAS that month. Likewise with any of the other holdings.
So what do you do if you have two that are under your target?
I generally choose the one that's furthest under its target, or if they're both quite similar under their target, I'll buy the one.
Flip a coin.
Essentially, it doesn't matter at that point.
No. Because you're dealing with such small percentages, I guess. So unless it's a huge percentage away, it doesn't matter that much.
Exactly. And just to note, doing this, my asset allocation has never deviated more than a couple of percent away from each of their target allocations. That's actually never happened.
In the month.
To me. In the month, yeah. So I've never actually needed to sell down and rebalance manually.
Even during February last year when the market was down 30-something percent? Do you remember? Or you can't remember?
May last year, I actually did a major reshuffle of my portfolio that wasn't to do with rebalancing.
Yeah.
So that was me cleaning up my portfolio and condensing it and making it simpler and more aligning it with my current investing philosophy, which is this four-fund portfolio I'm mentioning now, which I'm very happy with.
It might have moved a fair bit during that month, so it definitely can move a fair bit in a month.
It definitely can.
That's not a typical month, though.
That's a very untypical month.
Okay. I buy every month as well, as I mentioned earlier. Sometimes twice, depending on how much cash we have, which kind of depends on how much maybe we had a bad month in terms of our property expenses or something like that. So it depends a little bit, usually at least once a month. And I use a lower cost broker than Pat does, so it's a little bit cheaper for me, so it doesn't hurt quite as much. And I'm a little bit more active than Pat with my investments. I don't keep like a super strict percentage of the funds in my portfolio that I have. It's more like ranges, I suppose, that I feel comfortable with for different holdings. And I guess part of this is I started investing my portfolio was all Australian shares. And in the last, I can't remember, couple of years, 1 to 2 years, I guess, I've been wanting to invest and diversify a little bit more into international shares. So I've been doing that over time. And so what I'll do is I'll try and add to that each month, but I'll also top up my other holdings at the same time. I don't really have like an immediate target, like, oh, I have to get my international index fund to 40% or whatever, like as soon as possible. I just don't really feel like that. So I'll top that up, buy a little bit every month or whatever. And then I might buy some top up, you know, one of my other funds or whatever. I like to buy kind of what has like we mentioned earlier, kind of what has struggled recently or whatever. So I'll balance those two things, like diversifying the portfolio a bit more with international shares, but then maybe also buying what has done poorly recently or something like that. So I kind of balance those two things a little bit.
Yeah, nice. Hey, you want to hear something funny? Just talking about investment properties.
Uh-huh.
I've had my first few random little expenses come out of my investment property. Ooh. In inverted commas.
Tell us more.
Oh, just an annual fire alarm inspection thing that needs to be done.
Oh, yeah, mate.
Yeah, no, that one never gets mentioned when you're looking at like the comparison of property versus shares. No one ever tells you about the annual fire alarm inspections.
Mate, that is absolute peanuts. Why would you bother talking about that? Are you serious?
Because it adds up.
I know it adds up, when you've got a list, when you've got a list of expenses, that one is so far down the list that it doesn't even register, because you've got another 15 expenses that are more expensive and like more frequent than that. So,
of course,
that one doesn't even register in the brain, mate.
Of course. Apparently, my letterbox also got blown over in the wind. And ooh. I needed someone to come and re-straighten up and concrete in the letterbox.
Oh, that's an interesting one. I haven't had that.
And obviously, the typical water bill. No, but it's just interesting. I'm going to actually start recording all of this nonsense to see how much all those little flies add up to over the year.
Ooh, don't do that. You'll be depressed. You don't want to know. You don't want to know.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty funny.
But, mate, it's tax deductible, so what do you want?
Oh, of course. I forgot. It's all tax. You're basically getting it back, man. You're getting it back.
Pat, it's paying for itself, mate. Don't worry about it.
The reluctant property investor. Here we go.
He's got us. It's all right. I can see it for everyone who's listening. I can see that Pat's got this healthy inner glow about his property investing that he doesn't want to let on. Gives him the warm fuzzies inside.
Yeah. As long as your property doesn't become like a meth lab, then you're doing pretty good.
That's a good benchmark.
That's a good benchmark. The tail end risks.
All right, let's do a little summary, mate.
Yeah. In short, buy when you have the money to buy. Every month is probably a good time frame to stay engaged and feel motivated. You can have some simple targets in mind for your holdings, but don't agonize over it. Many people do. As we've stated before, if your portfolio is in low-cost, long-term, diversified investments, like index funds, the details aren't likely to matter very much.
So there's no right answer for everyone in terms of managing your portfolio and how you want to go about it and the different processes. But we hope today's episode has helped break it down a little bit and simplify a few things and help you think about how you are going to manage your own share portfolio as you build it. If you enjoyed the show today, we'd love it if you could leave us a little review in Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app, just to let other people know that this is a show worth listening to. Appreciate you taking the time to tune in. We look forward to bringing you more practical and no-nonsense content in the future, so stay tuned for that. All right, we'll see you next time.